Hello there. Today is Friday, March 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, thousands will observe a day of mourning in New Zealand as the Prime Minister bans assault weapons. The White House makes a major foreign policy announcement.
We will redouble our efforts to make sure that we protect all that is important.
Also ahead, it's Women's History Month, and this singer was one of the originals talking about female power. It's all on today's International Edition. A week after Cyclone Idai hit Mozambique, aid workers are racing against time to save people who remain cut off from food and medical aid. Officials say the death toll from the disaster is rising. United Nations World Food Program's Hervé Verhoezel says hundreds of thousands of people have been caught up in the cyclone's destructive path across southern Africa.
1.7 million people were on the path of the cyclone in Mozambique only. Those numbers come from satellite pictures and analyzed from WFP. The government estimates that 600,000 people are affected in Mozambique, but that number will definitely go up.
He says the other problem is that teams just can't get supplies in due to continued bad weather conditions.
The problem that we have is more the access. Then we can have the food coming, but then we have a problem of distribution of that food to people, because most of the people are basically on a rooftop or in a place where we cannot access by road.
For VOA, Mohamed Youssef in Nairobi has more on the efforts.
Mozambican rescue teams, with the help of aid agencies, are trying to reach the people who have been cut off for days by floods and extreme winds that hit the southern African nation. The cyclone displaced more than 500,000 Mozambicans, many of whom are now living in camps. Titus Jueros dos Santos is the Red Cross program director. He says rescuers have picked up 1,000 people by air and boat.
We have a challenge. Our challenge is to find the people in affected areas by floods. We have help for another institutions and another countries. They have given helicopters. These helicopters rescue the people from affected areas by the floods. It's a challenge because there are areas where flooding difficult to reach.
According to the Ministry of Environment, Cyclone Idai killed 217 people in Mozambique. The ministry says it expects the death toll to go up as aid workers gain access to affected areas in the center of the country. The government says its priority will be to provide food and medical assistance to those affected by the floods. Forecasters predict torrential rains are expected through Thursday and flood waters are still rising. The UN World Food Programme said it was transporting enough aid for 600,000 people, and the UN has allocated $20 million to respond to the crisis. Mohamed Youssef for VOA News, Nairobi.
And with one tweet, President Trump again has signaled a significant shift in U.S. foreign policy, and once again it involves Israel. Joining us to discuss is VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman. So, Steve, what exactly did the president announce?
The president took to Twitter and announced that, as far as he's concerned, that Israel has sovereignty over the disputed Golan Heights. Now, that's that overlook that was part of Syria until it was captured by Israel in 1967 when there was heavy Syrian shelling during what was called the Six-Day War. And this came out of the blue to a lot of people, but the timing is very interesting because the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, is to be here at the White House early next week, and the Israeli Prime Minister right now is engaged in a very tough re-election battle and is facing some legal issues as well. So this is a huge boost for Netanyahu at this particular juncture.
Does it appear that this is a president that is actively trying to assist the Prime Minister to get reelected?
There's no doubt of that there's a very friendly relationship between President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu. The Israeli Prime Minister did not have a good relationship with Trump's predecessor, Barack Obama, and they have been praising each other very constantly. So there's no doubt, I think, that Trump would like to see his friend reelected and is maybe trying to give him some sort of boost.
Right, because he's got a tough fight ahead with investigations of his own.
Right.
Going on. Why is this decision so unprecedented and such a big deal?
Well, it's a big deal because the Israeli occupation is not recognized by the international community. It is considered land that was captured in war and not annexed with any sort of international recognition. So that's why it's a really big deal. And not only the Syrians, of course, but you're going to see the Palestinians and Arab states protesting this move. The position in Israel is that this is really something that's been de facto because the Israelis are not, under current conditions, going to give up the strategic advantage of the Golan to protect Israel. And there are also Israelis who will say that there's been a Jewish presence there back to the 5th century before the Common Era, and that by Golan being under Israeli control, especially at a time when Syria is enmeshed in a rough, very complicated civil war, that not only the Jews there, but the Arabs and the Druze are also safer, knowing that the Syrians or other forces are not going to be able to move into that area.
Meanwhile, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was in Israel at the time of the announcement and reiterated the United States' support.
President Trump made a bold decision to recognize that an important decision for the people of Israel will truly be historic. And the people of Israel should know that the battles they fought, the lives that they lost on that very ground, were worthy and meaningful and important for all time.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu also quick to praise Trump for the decision.
We are deeply grateful for the U.S. support. We're deeply grateful for the unbelievable and unmatchable support for our security and our right to defend ourselves.
Netanyahu will be in Washington meeting with the president next week. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Airstrikes target the last defenders of the ISIS caliphate. Mindful of history, Democrats hold off on attempts to impeach Trump. U.S. missile defense cuts are worrying analysts. And are the friendly skies safe? Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Multiple Democratic-led committees are battling with the White House over documents as they launch broad new investigations of Trump and his personal and political dealings. On Tuesday, Congressman Elijah Cummings accused the White House of perpetrating an unprecedented level of stonewalling, delay, and obstruction in response to congressional requests for documents and witnesses. Sources say the White House is intentionally ignoring the requests. Cummings wrote in a Washington Post op-ed that he has sent 12 letters to the White House on a range of topics, ranging from security clearances to the use of taxpayer funds for lavish private aircraft. Since then, he wrote, the Trump administration has not turned over a single piece of paper to the committee or made a single official available for testimony. Joining us for analysis is George Mason University Professor of Governmental Affairs, Robert Deitz. What exactly is at issue here?
I'm shocked in a way. And yet, in another way, it's consistent with the way Mr. Trump has conducted himself, meaning in any kind of inquiry, whether it's a judicial inquiry or a legislative inquiry, we're all used to people saying, yes, I'll cooperate. And they'll say, of course, we'll provide these documents that you want, you know, with a qualification, I'm not going to provide attorney-client privileged documents and stuff like that. But the way our society works, the way, you know, most societies work is if lawful officials demand documents, you provide them. Mr. Trump is cut from a different mold, and I think what he's doing now with respect to the Hill is ignoring it. And that's a new way of addressing this issue, meaning what do you do if somebody doesn't say yes and doesn't say no, but just ignores the request? And I think this is going to be very interesting to watch. Now, the next step is for the Hill is to subpoena the documents. Generally, not necessary with the White House, but it may be necessary here. Notice that that means that if the judiciary orders the White House to pass these documents on and Trump ignores that order, then what happens? And that's, to me, is the really interesting question that may end up being presented here.
Why is this different as far as Congress requesting documents from the White House? Is it something the White House is allowed to refuse to do?
No, that's the incredible thing.
Is it the obligation of the White House to turn over this stuff, or are they
Absolutely.
Allowed to refuse or ignore that?
Absolutely. Of course they have an obligation. And what I'm saying is that Mr. Trump seems to be testing this convention, that is, that when a court orders something, you do it. And he has shown, as you know, he has in numerous cases shown hostility, skepticism toward courts.
What would happen if they just continue to refuse or ignore the requests?
Well, I assume the Hill will issue a subpoena, and if that's ignored, then the question of enforcement arises. And I assume they might go to the federal courts for a subpoena as well, and then seek enforcement by presumably the U.S. Marshals or the FBI. But that's inconceivable that you're going to have an FBI raid on the White House. What Mr. Trump seems to be testing, and really has done so in some ways from the beginning of his presidency, is the division among the three branches of government, the executive, the legislature, and the judicial, and does not show a whole lot of respect for the judiciary, as you know, and from time to time shows a fair amount of disrespect for the legislature. You know, his going it alone on the wall, ignoring a legislative determination. And I can't help wondering whether what we may be seeing in the reaction of the White House is testing, again, the division among the three branches of government and challenging the authority of the legislature to inquire of the president.
The other issue that the White House is refusing to give up to Congress is a request for documents on President Trump's communications with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Does that fall in the same category or is that different?
It's similar but different. And on that area, Mr. Trump is on somewhat firmer ground. That is, in negotiations with foreign leaders, a president wants a lot of freedom and traditionally has been granted a lot of freedom. And I suspect he would claim quite rightly that as chief executive officer, he has a right to confidential communications with foreign leaders.
All right. George Mason University Professor of Governmental Affairs, Robert Deitz, thanks for your perspective. People across New Zealand will listen to the Muslim call of prayer today as the nation marks 1 week since a gunman attacked two mosques and killed 50 people. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern and thousands of others will congregate in Hagley Park opposite the Al Noor Mosque in Christchurch. An imam says he's expecting thousands of people for the emotional prayer service. Meanwhile, the prime minister says New Zealand is immediately banning sales of military-style semi-automatic rifles and high-capacity magazines like the weapons used in last Friday's attacks on two mosques. She said the man arrested in the attacks had purchased his weapons legally and enhanced their capacity by using 30-round magazines done easily through a simple online purchase.
The issue we have is at the moment these guns, which have the power to kill en masse, are able to be legally purchased or very easily modified in order to be used, as we saw on Friday. Our focus is removing that ability. In our minds, this change will have the vast majority of support from New Zealanders, and I include New Zealanders who hold gun licenses.
At least 42 people died at the Al Noor Mosque and at least 7 at the nearby Linwood Mosque in last Friday's attack. Arab media is reporting that over 50 people have drowned after a tour boat overturned in the swollen Tigris River near Mosul. Witnesses claim that only four survivors were saved due to the swift current of the river. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Amateur video showed passengers of the overturned tour boat being rapidly carried away by the swift current of the swollen Tigris River near Mosul. Bystanders along the river say most of the passengers were women and children celebrating Nowruz and that few survivors were rescued. General Saad Man, Iraqi Interior Ministry spokesman, tried to downplay the number of casualties and refused to give a precise figure for casualties. He says most of the victims were women and children going on a pleasure cruise to celebrate the spring Nowruz holiday near a well-known island outside Mosul. He says that rescue operations are ongoing, so it's impossible to give an exact figure yet for the number of dead. Iraqi human rights activist Ali Maizer al-Shamri told Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV that he thinks there were over 100 passengers on the tour boat and that only four people were saved. Shamri blamed the owners of the tour boat for allowing too many people to board the ship. He says rapid currents on the river made it impossible to rescue many people. Parliament member Ahmed Jabouri claimed the boat was carrying more than 150 passengers and that casualty figures could rise dramatically. Most of the bodies, he insists, were carried away by the rapid current and have probably been taken away to the south of Mosul. Unconfirmed reports asserted that members of several prominent Shiite militia groups, popularly known as Hashd al-Shaabi, reportedly owned the tour boat that capsized. Arab media reports say that Prime Minister Adel Abdel Mahdi cut short meetings in Baghdad to travel to Mosul. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Well, it might take longer than Boeing had expected to get its 737 MAX jets flying again following two deadly crashes in 5 months. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
Although Boeing had hoped to finish by Monday a software update to prevent automation from pushing a jet's nose downward, it's going to take additional time to get the changes certified and pilots up to speed, perhaps into the summer. Bucking tradition, European and Canadian air regulators have announced they will do their own safety certifications, not accepting the certification from the Federal Aviation Administration. Airline analyst Richard Abulafia.
Frankly, the FAA is at risk of losing some of its power, its soft power in terms of worldwide image.
There are investigations into whether the FAA relied too much on Boeing for critical safety matters. At least one subpoena has been issued. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Venezuelan opposition leader and self-declared interim president Juan Guaido says intelligence agents working for President Nicolas Maduro have arrested his chief of staff. Guaido aide Roberto Marrero was taken into custody in an overnight raid on his home, and they do not know his whereabouts. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is demanding Marrero's immediate release and said those behind the arrest will be held accountable. The country's humanitarian crisis is worsening, as is the crumbling health system. After a nationwide electrical shutdown cut power for many days, major hospitals in Caracas continue to face serious problems, including a lack of running water, supply shortages, and enough staff to operate properly. For VOA, Alvaro Algara has more from Caracas with Christina Sacedo-Smith narrating.
One of the oldest and most recognized hospitals in Venezuela, the University Hospital in Caracas, is in critical and deteriorating condition. Operating rooms are non-functional, dirty and without supplies. Elevators don't work and only 15% of the hospital is open. Patients explain there is no medicine for treatment.
There are no medicines now. We have to go and buy them on the street. Bathrooms are disgusting, rooms are terrible, and this place is horrible.
Doctors say the hospital doesn't have enough medicine and supplies for special care units, for dialysis, oncology, and operating rooms. The hospital doesn't have running water in the upper level floors because the main water pump isn't working. Doctors say, as a result, people are dying.
Es un área clínica, hay déficit, escasez de antibiótico, yerco,
At the emergency room, there is a shortage of antibiotics, not to mention cancer patients that need chemotherapy or radiotherapy. We are daily witnesses on how patients die due to the lack of supplies and medicines.
Diabetic patient Encarnacion Pujol's leg is going to be amputated because the insulin he desperately needs is nowhere to be found.
I don't want to lose my leg. It's fine. They can cut my foot, but don't take it off. Please help. Don't let them cut my leg.
The University Hospital seems to have stopped performing operations. People are walking in the hallways. Patients are being taken in wheelchairs or stretchers. Rooms and beds are empty. Hospital nutritionist Jacqueline Diaz says there is no food for patients. Instead of giving them healthy meals to help patients with recovery, staff are giving them whatever they can find.
We have several months that patients only eat lentils with corn cake. Patients who have liquefied diets, they have to eat boiled rice water because there is no milk to give them.
The Minister of Health in Venezuela, Carlos Alvarado, says there is a contingency plan in place to restock Venezuela's hospitals and keep them running. Recently, Russia and the Pan American Organization delivered more than 7 tons of aid. Meanwhile, more than 180 metric tons of U.S. aid continues to pile up along the Venezuela border, blocked by the in-dispute Maduro government, as nation's hospitals reach a catastrophic breaking point. For Álvaro Algarra in Caracas, Cristina Caicedo-Smith, VOA News, Washington.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Next up, the 16th anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq and a status update on Syria and the growing role of Iran in both nations. We talk with Barbara Leaf, former U.S. ambassador to the UAE, and Ellen Lapson, professor at George Mason University. That's Encounter, Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices
with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka. Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. Finland ranked as the world's happiest country for the second consecutive year in a new United Nations report. The other Nordic countries, as well as the Netherlands, Switzerland, Canada, New Zealand, and Austria, made the top 10 in the happiness survey of 156 countries. South Sudan sank to the bottom, and other war-torn countries also ranked low. VOA's Zlatika Hoke has more.
Finland is known for long, cold winters, its beautiful forests, and its extensive welfare system. Its economy is comparable to other European economies. So what makes the Finns such a happy nation? They themselves are not quite sure.
Our economy is doing fine, and I don't know, maybe we are really close to the nature.
It certainly is not the weather.
It can't be because of the climate. We've had such a long and dark winter, but maybe it's the level of security.
It's safe here. You don't have to be scared all the time, and you can trust people.
The happiness in Finland is boosted by access to nature, safety, affordable childcare, free education, and heavily subsidized healthcare. The other top 10 countries ranked high for similar reasons. It is understandable why conflict-ridden countries such as South Sudan, the Central African Republic, and Afghanistan would rank low. But the United States, the world's most powerful country and number one economy, continued to slide, dropping to 19th place this year. The report attributes the U.S. decline to depression, caused mainly by addictions, ranging from substance abuse to gambling and digital media. The countries that have seen the biggest gains in the past decade are in Central and Eastern Europe, Sub-Saharan Africa, and several in Latin America. Yemen, India, Syria, Botswana, and Venezuela have experienced the largest declines. The report looked into factors that could affect the happiness of a nation, including economic output, social support, governance, healthy life expectancy, absence of corruption, and generosity. It found that people tend to feel happier if they help others, but if they do so by choice. The increased time spent on social media is linked to a decline in happiness, especially among adolescents. Happy people are more likely to vote for the incumbent. Recent gains of populist politicians could be the result of their ability to appeal to unhappy voters. The report stresses that there are many variables that can affect a nation's happiness, and no simple explanations are applicable to all.
You just need to remind yourself when you feel about complaining about the weather that we're really happy here. We're on our way to afternoon tea.
One thing seems invariable. Sunny weather does not guarantee happiness. Zlatica Hoc, VOA News, Washington.
I am woman, hear me roar in numbers today. In 2011, then President Barack Obama declared March Women's History Month. The focus for each year's celebration varies widely, but they are all centered around the myriad of issues facing women around the world. And for our music segment, as we close out the show, we are reminded of a song that became a part of the culture of celebrating female empowerment and an anthem for the women's liberation movement. Australian songwriter and singer Helen Reddy wrote the lyrics and performed this song, I Am Woman, which was not only a huge hit, but also heard during the closing credits of the 1972 film Stand Up and Be Counted. Reddy says she feels like the song was divinely inspired to send a message, and she remembers lying in bed and the words, I am strong, I am invincible, I am woman, ran through her head over and over as she wrote the song.
And I come back even stronger, not a novice any longer, 'cause you deepen the conviction in my soul. Oh, yes,
you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Keith Holmes. I am Lori London. Thanks for joining us.
I am invincible. Standing toe to toe as I spread my loving arms across the land. But I'm still an embryo with a long, long way to go until I make my brother understand. Oh, yes, I am wise, but it's wisdom born of pain. Yes, I've paid the price, but look how much I've gained. If I
This is VOA.